Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined by Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. Hey, Antonio.
Hey, Zach, how you doing?
Doing well. John Kennedy is out for one more week, but he'll be back soon, so Antonio and I have you covered today. After weeks of slamming vote by mail, Donald Trump reversed course when it comes to Florida and said the system actually works pretty well here. Meanwhile, U.S. Senator Rick Scott is raising concerns about adding to the federal budget deficit as lawmakers consider another coronavirus relief bill. And Florida Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried rolled out her own coronavirus plan this week. We'll talk about all that and more, but first, that music means it's time to pick some numbers. Antonio, you got a number for us?
Yeah, Zach, I am going to go with the number one. Very simple. Number one.
Number one. All right. Like a Sesame Street number here. My number is 502,739. So that's one for Antonio Finns and 502,739 for me. Remember those numbers, folks. Write them down. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, the coronavirus has raised big concerns about the safety of voting, prompting many elections officials to promote mail-in ballots as an alternative for those worried about voting in person. Some states are mailing ballots to all voters, while states like Florida are seeing a big increase in absentee ballot requests. President Trump hasn't been happy with the mail vote-by-mail push, saying it could make it easier to commit voter fraud. He repeatedly is railed against voting by mail, but this week he changed course somewhat and came out in favor of absentee voting here in Florida. The president tweeted, quote, "In Florida, I encourage all to request a ballot and vote by mail." Antonio, why do you think Trump felt the need to express his support for vote by mail here in Florida?
Well, because of, you know, he used mail-in voting in the March 17th presidential primary, and the contradiction opened him up to accusations that he is being hypocritical. You know, on top of that, you know, the mail-in voting process in Florida was a brainchild of Republican lawmakers who passed a reform legislation about 20 years ago. And it's been a system effectively used by Republicans in Florida, and often more so than Democrats. So clearly, there was, you know, that he was ripping a system that in his adopted home state, you know, has been very successful. So, you know, the problem he has right now is that his explanation continues to get, you know, more twisted than a churro and cayocho in Miami. I mean, the president keeps saying that he's trying to draw this distinction between absentee voting and mail-in voting. And in his argument, he says, you know, Florida uses absentee voting while other states, Democratic, blue and purple states, use mail-in voting. And the difference, he says, is in absentee voting, you request a ballot in lieu of going to the polls. Other states, Washington State, Oregon, Nevada, those states, he says, you know, conducting an election with much larger use of mailed-in ballots. And this unfounded allegation that they just mail millions of ballots out into the netherland of their communities and who knows what they get back, which it's not true. A lot of these states have a very long history of mail-in voting. They use it very effectively. And, and that argument that he's making is getting debunked even by members of his own party, you know, high-ranking Republicans. Just this week, you know, John Thune, the number two Republican in the U.S. Senate, said, you know, quote unquote, mail-in voting has been used in a lot of places for a long time. You know, honestly, we've got a lot of folks, as you know, who are investing heavily to win that war. It's always a war for mail-in ballots. Both sides competing. It's always an area where I think our side, at least in my experience, Thune said, has done very well. And then he added on top of this, you know, I don't want to discourage people. I think we want to assure people that it's going to work. You know, it's secure, quote unquote, it's secure. And if they vote that way, it's going to count. Boom. You know, there goes, you know, Trump's argument. So, the president continues to dig himself into a hole all by himself. And the more that he does, the more it raises a question that another Republican, Tom Ridge, who was George W. Bush's first Secretary of Homeland Security, you know, said last week on national television that he wonders if Trump is more worried about losing than about fraud. You know, and, you know, interesting, the president has always shown success in redefining issues and redefining people. Remember what he said, you know, the way that he boiled down the Mueller investigation to a hoax. the Ukraine phone call was a perfect phone call. You know, the government shutdown was about the wall and, you know, protecting against these invasions. You know, and largely it's worked for him. On this issue, it's not. It's just his entire explanation, Zach, is to redefine mail-in voting as flawed and easily defrauded. It's failing. It's not working. You know, other than his diehards, no one is buying it. And a reason may be that so many Americans have used in the past. So many Americans have used it successfully and just aren't buying his argument, you know, regardless of whether Republicans, Democrats, Independents. It may just be that for a lot of people, in the view of a lot of people, the president is just on the wrong side of this, and glaringly so.
And I've talked to Republicans who were pretty nervous here in Florida about the president's repeated attacks on vote by mail, because they actually view it as something that is a benefit for them, that can be effective for them, that they've used effectively in past elections. But Democrats are cleaning their clocks right now in vote by mail. The executive director of the Florida Democratic Party, Juan Penalosa, tweeted yesterday that the Democrats have returned 123,000 more vote by mail ballots than the Florida GOP, and they've requested substantially more vote by mail ballots as well here in Sarasota County, which is a very Republican leaning. Trump won by double digits here. Democrats have about a 15,000 vote by mail request advantage over Republicans. You know, there's big concern here, because vote by mail, if a voter gets that ballot in the mail and it's sitting at their house, they are more likely to fill it out and return it than they are to actually go and vote on election day. So you have higher voter turnout for vote by mail. And so, you know, Republicans are worried that this is going to increase Democratic voter turnout. Now, they're also saying that it's not clear that this is going to be a huge advantage, that Democrats basically have to increase their vote by mail because their voters are more concerned about voting in person, and that Republicans will show up in person on election day, and that Democrats are basically just cannibalizing their election day vote and moving that to vote by mail. So it's not clear that, you know, the stronger vote by mail requests and returns by Democrats for this primary are going to result in a huge advantage. But when you consider, the turnout increase that you get from vote by mail, it is a trend that Democrats are happy about and Republicans are a little bit nervous about. So it seems like somebody has prevailed on Trump and explained this to him, that here in Florida, especially, this is something that could be beneficial for Republicans. But I wonder, Antonio, if Tom Ridge is saying that he's more concerned about losing and that this isn't really about, that this isn't really about fraud, do you think that he's worried that in other places, unlike Florida, that really, you know, vote by mail, that it is just going to benefit Democrats, that basically this is going to increase Democratic turnout, and he's just trying to suppress that?
Well, I think that what he's looking at is that there are a lot of these states, you know, widespread use of vote by mail, the universal vote by mail processes that he sees to be criticizing, is largely in America a progressive idea. And that means it's been employed in the bluest of the blue states. So, and he has, throughout his 10 years president, you know, he has drawn this distinction between blue states and red states. And part of it is, you know, his political calculation that this is where he's won. The problem is that he's just not on the right side of this. Across the country, people of all political viewpoints have used this process and have used it very successfully. And they're just not buying his argument that this is rife for fraud. And part of it is, I mean, look, it's been out there that he seems that he is trailing the polls, and every time another poll comes out showing that he is trailing in a battleground state, he tends to raise this issue. So it's almost like shades of 2016 when he talked about the rigged election, almost trying to set up a what happens if I lose? How do I make an argument that this was rigged and that, to maybe he raised the specter of litigation last week. And maybe he's trying to set some type of table so that he can challenge election results. And to what end, who knows? But the bottom line is that at the grassroots level, Americans are just not buying this argument, and partly because they've used this system and are comfortable with it.
Well, while Trump was encouraging vote by mail in Florida, the state's junior U.S. senator took to the Senate floor to decry growing federal budget deficits and the growing federal debt. Unfortunately, my party has shown an almost equal disregard for the dangers our growing national debt and annual deficits, as have the Democrats, said Rick Scott, adding, our federal government is borrowing an unprecedented amount of money. Scott noted that between March and June, borrowing rose by $2.9 trillion. Of course, that was the period where both parties were pushing hard to push coronavirus relief packages as the government basically shut down most of the private, a lot of the private sector to try and contain the virus. The GOP under Trump hasn't been too concerned about debt and deficits, whether it was passing a massive tax cut or spending that money on coronavirus relief. The president seems to want another round of relief, which could help limit the blowback against him from the current economic downturn, but would also increase the deficit. Antonio, are you surprised that Scott was willing to speak out about budget deficits when Trump obviously doesn't want to really be bothered with this right now?
No, I'm not. And there are three reasons why I think that I'm not surprised. One is, let's face it, Rick Scott is a fiscal hawk. He has raised this topic on and off in the past, even before there was a pandemic and we were spending trillions of dollars to handle it. And it's one of the reasons why he's actually made the argument against the federal unemployment jobless add-on, that the $600 per week supplement that has expired and that Congress is wrangling over.
Right, right. But like, he is a fiscal hawk, and a lot of Republicans have styled themselves as fiscal hawks. I mean, Rick Scott as governor really bragged about decreasing borrowing, decreasing the state debt. I mean, that was, one of his big talking points, that he decreased state debt by billions of dollars and that he didn't authorize a lot of new borrowing. But a lot of Republicans were like that, before Trump became president, and they've basically quieted down about it because the president doesn't want to. It doesn't seem like he wants to make a lot of spending cuts, which can be unpopular. So for Scott, that seems a little unusual.
But he's not really, because remember, Rick Scott his political roots are in the Tea Party movement. And the Tea Party movement came to be in large part because of the 2008 bailout and runaway government spending. So, and on top of that, you are seeing elected Republican officials across this country coming under increased criticism for abandoning traditional Republican issues. The Lincoln Project being chief among them. So, even before the pandemic, Republicans were even starting to get heartburn trying to explain why the Trump administration has had ballooning annual deficits. So I really don't think it's any kind of mystery why Rick Scott, spoke out. The question is, where does he go from here? So he dropped his speech on the Senate floor on Wednesday and then promptly went on Fox News to amplify his message, amid this debate about the federal unemployment benefits extension. And the jobless benefits is a big issue. We've talked about this plenty of times, but it's a big issue both in terms of household finances for people who've lost jobs and the politics, the political consequences that may come of that in just less than 3 months. A poll released this week by Unidos US shows that 60% of Florida Hispanics, for example, have lost two sources of income as a result of the coronavirus business shutdown. And across Florida, we could say the same about Floridians of all sorts of ethnic backgrounds and races, can say the same thing, that they have taken a huge financial hit and are experiencing significant hardship because of that. So where does Rick Scott take this? Having made the case that fiscal discipline is important and paramount, can he turn around and vote for another assistance package in Congress that could be another $1 trillion aid package with unemployment benefits that he has decried as a disincentive to work? And if he continues to speak out against the jobless assistance benefits, is that something voters who have suffered profoundly are going to remember in 2024? Now, that he gave the speech is no surprise. The question is, how does he merge his fiscal conservative position with his voting record you know, amid in just an extraordinary time in American politics and economics, and in Florida as well.
Well, it seems like if he doesn't vote against the coronavirus relief package, he's kind of a hypocrite at this point, right? I mean, he's basically come out and said this borrowing is unsustainable. You think he's going to vote for it? I mean, to me, it seems like he's kind of signaling that he's probably going to vote against him, which would put him at odds with the president, which is not a place that he likes to be.
You know, unless there's a calculation being made that Trump's base is eroding. And particularly that the Tea Party crowd is eroding and getting soured on this. And, you know, look, Rick Scott, say what you want about him, but he knows his base and he knows the politics. And, you know, he's won three really tight elections, you know, against the grain of politics. So, you know, he may be seeing something in the political winds that others are not.
Yeah. I don't know, though. It doesn't seem to me like Trump's base is eroding. I think the passion is still there from everything that I've seen. You know, that there's still a lot of people who strongly believe in the president. But I do think that the concerns about deficits and debt are growing, and maybe people can hold both of those things in their heads, that they support the president even while they are concerned about this. So maybe he's trying to speak to that and what comes next here within the party, but we'll see. Well, as Congress considers another round of coronavirus relief, Florida officials are still grappling with one of the worst virus outbreaks in the country. This week, Florida Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, the only statewide elected Democrat, rolled out her own plan for combating the virus. Fried's Be Smart Florida plan has familiar recommendations from wearing masks to social distancing to hand washing. The campaign includes some social media videos, a radio PSA. Antonio Fried isn't really proposing anything new here, but she attracted some attention with this campaign, which seems fairly media savvy and is the kind of thing you might see from a governor. And it's sort of fueling some of the speculation that she wants to run for governor in 2022. And I just saw an article this morning that she actually told a radio station in South Florida that she was considering running for governor in 2020. Do you think sort of positioning yourself for a run for governor in the middle of a pandemic is good politics?
Well, we know this for sure. Governor Ron DeSantis sees her as a rival. You know, let's remember, DeSantis omitted Nikki Fried from that reopened Florida task force, despite inviting the other members of the Florida cabinet to participate, and actually almost inviting every other person in Florida to participate. I mean, that was a long list of people on those reopened Florida task forces. But look, Fried has been a frequent critic of the governor. You know, just this week, she criticized his decision to cancel an August 11th meeting of the Florida cabinet because of COVID-19 concerns. At the same time, the governor continues to insist it's okay to open schools and welcome students for in-classroom teaching. So, you know, Fried is the lone statewide Democrat. You know, she clearly has political ambitions, and she is making a name for herself and, you know, getting out there and being sort of the rival to DeSantis at the state level. Plus, you know, she is a longtime cannabis advocate. She was a lobbyist for, you know, the legalization of marijuana. So she has a base, a solid constituency. So that she would plan to run in 2024, that's clearly, if you do the political math, that's there. Now, let's face it, challenges to incumbents in Florida generally do not work. You know, the last time an incumbent governor seeking to retain the job, the last time he lost that race was, you know, 30 years ago when Republican Governor Bob Martinez lost to U.S. Senator Lawton Childs in the 1990 gubernatorial election. The previous time to that example was in the 1960s. You know, and there is a really long way to go before we get to 2024. I mean, just look at what's happened this year.
2022.
You know, 2022. You know, there's still a long way to go there. I mean, just look at what happened this year. And in the middle of a pandemic, there is a political risk there, but clearly, Nikki Fried has her eyes on the prize. And, you know, we can be, and all of us, including her, can be forgiven for thinking it's the governor's mansion down the road. If it's 2022 or 2026, we'll see. But she will run for another office. That's guaranteed.
Yeah, I think she's made it abundantly obvious that she's going to run for governor, or at least that she's like very, very, very strongly considering it and trying to position herself for it. And it's interesting. I mean, she's been kind of throwing bombs from the sidelines and criticizing DeSantis and criticizing DeSantis. And, you know, that probably appeals to a lot of Democrats, especially, and some independents, and even some Republicans who are critical that the governor hasn't enacted any other statewide mandates and been more aggressive about trying to tamp down coronavirus infections. But this campaign seems like trying to go beyond that, because you do run the risk if you're just constantly criticizing and, you know, making comments from the sidelines that you're not seen as being productive and not seen as actually trying to solve the problem. And so I think this campaign, where she's putting out social media videos, I mean, this is something that a lot of people have talked about, that public health officials need to be more aggressive about education. If you're not going to do mandates, then, you know, you should have a really aggressive education campaign to tell people what the right thing to do is, because, you know, without, you know, some guidance, people still aren't exactly sure. There's a lot of different information out there that people find online. And so, you know, an education campaign being put forward here, this might be her effort to try and say, well, I'm trying to be constructive here. I'm trying to guide people through this. I'm trying to give them good information and protect their health. She still runs the risk, though, of you know, trying to, you know, be that people might see her as being, you know, too political in the midst of a public health crisis. But this is also a huge opportunity for her to raise her profile. So it's probably a risk that she's willing to take. We'll move on to some number picking here. Antonio, your number was one. You want to tell us about that?
Sure, Zach. I mean, on this podcast, when it comes to the pandemic, coronavirus, we tend to talk a lot about numbers. You know, this past week, the state topped 500,000 infections, second only to California now. We talk about the, you know, the 1 million plus Floridians that have filed and unique claims for unemployment benefits, and the governor's mentioned the $12 billion is going to get out to them. But, you know, the more I think about it, the more the one number that counts, the number that counts the most, and how people across the state, how their views of the pandemic are shaped, the number they think that counts the most is the number one. And that number one stands for that one person you know, that one anecdote. And I was reminded of this in two occasions this week. One was a very, you know, very sad conversation I had with my niece, who the father of her best friend passed away from coronavirus last Sunday. And then the other one person that I know too is a personal friend of mine, you know, a great immigrant story. This guy is an inspiring, successful story. You know, he's the last year and a half, he's been ready, he and a partner, to open up a restaurant in Pompano Beach in Broward County. It was going to happen this month, and it's been postponed because of the pandemic. And, you know, and I'm thinking that across the state, you know, everybody has that one story, that one person they know, that the, or if it's not them, someone who's been personally affected by this. So when we look at all the polls about, you know, how people feel about the pandemic and who's doing a good job and who's not doing a good job and how they've been personally touched, I mean, a lot of that all comes down to that one anecdote, that one person you know. And for me, that was driven home this week. So that's why I picked, you know, the number one, because that one person you know is probably the way it's going to shape, more than any other number and anything else, any other statistic and any other briefing, that one personal connection that you saw somebody suffer from this, that's what's going to drive the way that you're going to view the pandemic and that, and perhaps how you will vote in November.
That's very true. And I'm sorry to hear that some folks that you know have been personally affected by this, but as this expands, I think you're right. I think a lot of people, this is not abstract anymore. This is personal for many, many people. And that might be one reason we're seeing some of the numbers start to improve, as people really are being personally affected by this and they're starting to make different decisions and be more careful. Here in Sarasota, our Congressman Vern Buchanan, one of his aides died of the coronavirus. Very popular, well-known guy, very friendly. I met him many times, and I think a lot of people that drove it home for people. There was a high school teacher at Sarasota high school who died. And I think that drove it home for a lot of people who knew him and had taken his classes and known him over the years. So I think you're right. A lot of people are being personally affected by this. Well, my number is 502,739. That's the number of coronavirus infections in Florida right now as of this moment. The state surpassed 500,000 infections this week, which is a pretty remarkable figure. One out of every 50 people in the state has been infected, and Florida now has more coronavirus cases than every country in the world except five. The good news is that Florida finally seems to be trending in the right direction, with the number of new infections and the number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 starting to dip down somewhat. But the state's coronavirus numbers are still incredibly high, and the virus will continue to overshadow every other issue in the state until it's under control. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy and Joseph Rosano. Thanks to all of you for listening. Stay safe. We're out of here.